Brian Reid. Brian Reid. On City Talk 105.9.
Hello, this is Brian Reid, and between now and 8 o'clock, there's another chance to hear the best of my Saturday morning show here on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. We got the product of a knee trembler between Derek Dougan and Dana. Everyone's thinking, who's Derek Dougan and Dana? It could have been Bernadette Devlin and Ian Paisley.
That would have been a great knee trembler, wouldn't it?
This is trembling!
No! Yes!
Whatever happened to Dana?
Dana, didn't she stand for the Senate in the South of Ireland? Right, she was in the Shannon. And she stood for president as well, didn't she?
But no could pin her down because she just stood for all kinds of everything.
All kinds of everything she was into.
We're going to have a good day today. Once a year, boozers out last night. Couldn't get into any pub. Even the crack, right?
Really?
Couldn't get through the door of the crack. It was just filled with these once a year.
Luckily,
boozers.
I had the presence of mind to have a mishap with a bottle of wine and a box set of The Wire last night.
That's not once a year for you, is it?
No, it's not actually. No, it's every Friday night I come on the show. I dropped my sister in law off in at Pogue's Mahone's on a.
You're so stereotypical, aren't you? You got to go to Pogue.
No, she's a scout. She's from Fernhill Gardens in Bootle.
You know what I mean?
But and town was rammed full of idiots drunk. Yeah. 7:30 last night, I felt like just mowing them down with the car. It'd been a civic duty. They should get rid of them. It's
well, people
social
who go out
Darwinism.
And drink.
People who are just out for once a year, like, you know.
Yeah, but you had to pick them out, wouldn't they? You would have got people who were like me who were out every night. Now, listen, there's been some great stories this week, right? All candidates for Review of the Year, which me, you, I don't know if you know this, but me, you, Lynn Papadopoulos and Mike Chappell are going to sit down and review the year in a couple of weeks.
Okay? I don't mean to let light in on magic here, Brian, but you did send me an email yesterday saying we've got to be here for 7:45 on Monday. So,
we're having a run through on Monday.
We're having a run through on Monday.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, one of the name of the year. Now, I watched name of all time.
Was Anurag Dipsit, who was the head of Ultimate Gaming this week. That's not how you pronounce it, by the way.
On Have I Got News For You last week, they let slip that the name of the general manager of Blair House, which is the American president's guest house in Washington, is Randy Bumgardner. Now, is that the greatest name ever? Randy Bumgardner. You've got a kid called Bumgardner, and you think, what name do you give it? What, you know, but you're in Heighton. The Bumgardeners of Heighton.
Yeah, yeah.
This kid's got to go through school. Let's call him Randy.
The Bootle Bumgardeners.
Anyway, yeah. I thought this was made up, this name, right? I thought I can't
Randolph.
Randy. So I checked it. I Googled it, right?
And you Googled Randy Bumgardner?
You try Googling Randy Bumgardner.
Anyway, I'd rather not, Brian.
And I came up with, it does exist. And I opened one entry there. And he'd been writing to somebody about genealogy, trying to trace back the family name.
The family tree. Name.
Yeah, yeah. So this was his email. Hi, Joe. Gladys Miller says she's a cousin of yours. I found her on the internet while doing some Bumgardner research. Now, the next time anybody gets done for downloading gay porn, just say,
I was doing some genealogy into the Bumgardners. Is that like a fellow Peter Shirt?
That's Pete Townsend's book, by the way. He hasn't come out yet, has he?
No, Pete Townsend's book's being proofread at the minute. Yeah. It's going to have to be very delicately proofread. What about Peter Shurtliff? He used to play for...
Peter Shurtliff?
Yeah, he used to play for Sheffield Wednesday.
Wednesday, yeah. Very, very easily related to the Bumgardners. Anyway, have you...
we've started off. The elephant in the room is the shoe-throwing reporter of old Baghdad.
That's what I was going to say. He's the man of the year.
That is the single greatest thing I've ever seen in the world. That you... decide you are in bed, you've been given credentials, you know yourself, Brian, you've brought you and your mates to like a press conference at the tennis tournament in Wirral, like, you know.
Yes.
you know to actually get press accreditation to a press conference with the president of the United States. You get there and you decide that it's not going the way you want it to. You're going to say, he's not saying what I want to, so you decide to take your shoe off and throw it at him.
I think it's premeditated.
It was this sick. Do you think so, really?
Oh, I think it might have been, yeah.
And you call him a dog. Wouldn't it have been great if he had
it
just...
It is the farewell kiss, you dog.
You dog.
It's just brilliant.
Wouldn't it have been great if he had just thrown loads more, but got more and more surreal? Where he like, threw a fish and then he had a big bucket full of, like, you know, confetti like a clown has in the circus. And I think it was the funniest thing I've seen for a long time.
In future, they're going to be going through people's bags of Semtex to find shoes, aren't they? But you know what? I mean, it was. And the press underplayed it greatly, I thought. I saw it on the news. I thought, oh, that's the front page. It was really because, I think for two reasons. Bush is now kind of yesterday's news, and he's such a buffoon. It's been so many kind
Bush is Rain Man now, isn't he? He's finally been seen for the Rain Man he is.
I hate to say this. And you know, when people go, you kind of, there's things you're going to miss. I'm going to miss George Bush. I am going to miss
him. No, you're not, Brian.
No, I
You
am.
Think you will.
No, I know he's a buffoon. I know he's a liar. I know he's a warmonger. I know he's a right-wing, very scary Republican. But there's something about him which is funny, and I think it's why he got elected. I mean, his response to that shoe throwing was, how do you feel? He said, I'm okay. All I can report is it's a size 10. You know, Gordon Brown couldn't come back with that.
I don't care. Gordon Brown didn't lose into Iraq. I don't care. No, you do it, but smiling.
He is... I know this is kind of, you know, I'm really, you know...
I know it's anti-satire, I'm sorry, but I know he's funny and everything.
He's and blokey, isn't he? You can see how he got elected.
Yeah. Oh, of course you can, yeah. He's great. He's brilliant. I mean, he's great, you know, America, you know, the problem with the French is they've got no word for entrepreneur. That's all right if it was just that, but he was in Iraq because he'd led them into a misguided five-year war. The least he can expect is for some madman to throw his shoes at him.
Remember Yo Blair?
Yeah, Yo Blair.
Yo Blair! Is he, mate? What's happening?
Yeah. And a solution to the Israeli crisis, of course, was you'll get those Syrians to stop doing that. Blah, 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 because then it'll be all over.
But it won't.
You cannot concertina 60 years of history or 13 centuries of history like that. Just get the Syrians to stop doing that and it'll be all be all right.
Are we going to miss George Bush?
Absolutely not.
One person. Again, I'm going strange on people that I really didn't like. Now I'm starting to like Heather Mills. It's only when she comes up again in the news that you think, I quite miss her not being in the news. But this, nobody really went on about this. This is the story of
I think this is the story of the year.
Of the year, okay.
Yeah.
In case you missed this, a columnist called Lucy Kellaway in the Financial Times.
Brian Reid reads the columnist in the Financial Times.
I read everyone. She's a very good columnist, actually. But anyway, she just threw this anecdote into a financial report for no reason. That's why she's very good at that. She said a friend of hers is at the same school that Beatrice McCartney goes to, or he knows the teacher there. Heather Mills turns up for parent night, right? Now, remember the name here, Beatrice McCartney, okay? She turns up for parents' night. She speaks to one of the teachers, and the teacher says, yeah, she's really good, Beatrice. She's doing really very bright. Oh, and I must say, she's very good at playing the recorder. Straight as a flash, Heather Mills come back with, she gets that from me. And that is true. She gets that. She gets playing her musical talent from me, not the man who's going down as one of the greatest living music writers, musicians. The man who's making more money out of music alive than anybody else.
I know. And it'd be even better if she'd taken her leg off and started playing it. Like she was like Ian Anderson from The Tull.
Oh, she did. That's what I was going to go and say. But you see, again, I saw in that why she only got 25. I mean, she's been really stupid to herself. She only got 25 million out of McCartney, who's worth a billion, right? That's a fortune.
No, Paul McCartney's not worth a billion. See,
he
fallacy.
Is worth
it's not,
a billion.
It's just, it's come to the point where it's like, it's we get big.
How
like
is
Paul
he
McCartney,
not worth a billion?
Paul McCartney. Well, first of all, we don't know. Secondly, because neither of us are qualifying anyway. But the other thing is, like, Paul McCartney and Bill Gates and those people are kind of like, you can just think of a number and treble it and it makes no difference.
Yeah, Bill Gates
it's such a huge amount of money. You say, he's worth seven squid.
No,
yeah, he is.
It's been worked out by the Sunday Times richness. But Bill Gates gives his money away to charity. McCartney doesn't do much of that.
No, he doesn't know.
Anyone who pay Denny Lane £200 a week does not give his money away to charity, right? You know. But see, everyone felt sorry for Guy Ritchie. Oh, guys ended up getting 50 million out of Madonna, right?
That's, no, he hasn't. People said he hasn't got 50 million.
He's going to, when the property's added up, he's going to get 50 million. You see, he wasn't mad, but when you're mad and the judge looks here,
he's now monkey.
Yeah, she gets that from me. Anything else, Paddy?
That's what Guy Ritchie goes to parents and he goes, he's got a terrible cockney accent. You get that for me, mate.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I know the Brian Reid show is complete without some reference to left-wing socialism, blah, blah, blah. I think if you find, go right through all the podcasts available on iTunes now, by the way, if you want.
Can you subscribe?
You can subscribe via
iTunes.
You've
subscribed to listen to yourself, haven't you?
I listen to myself.
You subscribe. You only listen to it once every 3 weeks.
I listen to it
three
times this
week.
Sitting
there with a cigar going, maybe I could enhance the little intonation.
I'm going to try and buy David Jacobs, see if he'll do a jury for us to give him a 10 out of 10. But I was listening to it in the pub, right? Nothing Thursday night, but I was proper bladders. But
go
socialism.
On. Socialism, yeah.
Unfettered.
It's alive and kicking.
Madoff. Your
Madoff. Madoff.
First of all, he's
up.
Called Madoff. Yeah. He made off with 32. How you can't write this kind of stuff, can you? The man has stolen £32.2 billion, $50 million. He's called Madoff.
Mm.
And I just think, surely someone's going to have to stand up and say, now, ultimately, the lesson we've learned is that the market doesn't regulate itself.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, if you let madmen who just have a thirst and zeal for money, just let them set them loose in the financial markets, what they ultimately do, and they always do this, is set up a pyramid scheme. The stuff that we tell housewives and Hayton and Kirby not to fall for is a pyramid scheme. £32 billion.
The people that gave them the money. These banks that we give our money to.
Yeah,
it's just billions. What happened at Gemma Fairpack 3 years ago? Those poor working class people who were consensus again.
Yeah.
And the government didn't step in.
No.
You've got MPs going, maybe we should all give up an hour's wages for them. These working class people trusted the system, who should have been protected.
52 weeks of the year were given a fiver or a tenner.
And the bank, I think it was HBOS, had pulled the rug in on Fairpack.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. They were taking, they knew exactly, they were banking that money, and they knew at some point they'd pull it. And these are the people now who we bail out to the tune of £500 billion. The lesson of this year is this, under Labour government. If you're on long-term sickness, you're going to face lie detector tests now to see if are greedy.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, men who pushed the world into the worst recessions of the 1920s, okay, are getting £500 billion for their greed and they're getting the Christmas bonus thrown in as well.
Yeah, £34 billion, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're all going to get the Christmas bonus.
It's like Bernard Madoff, this is from the Times, Bernard Madoff, the Wall Street trader, allegedly responsible. Now, I think we can categorically prove that he is responsible. Yeah. Once you can find £50 billion missing... Yeah. You don't need some kind of jury. He's going to be tagged and placed under house arrest and could face time in jail. Now, one thing we have found out, and I know I'm the greenest columnist that you have on the show. I'm going to use something I didn't use the last time around. But what we should find out is that the last person who got done for a massive financial scam was Conrad Black, wasn't it? Conrad Black, who was the erstwhile owner of the Telegraph and various other enterprises.
He's now in a penthouse, isn't he? He's in a penthouse suite.
He's now in Coleman Prison. Yeah. The Coleman Prison in Florida, mm-hmm. where his missus lives in a £7 million house around the corner. Mm. But he's written in a piece he wrote for the Times called From My Cell, I Sent the Reeking Soul of US Justice. He said... he said, prison isn't as bad as I thought. Many of my co-inmates are quite interesting and affable, often in a Damon Runyon style way. Mm. Well, I mean, they speak of the present tense all the time, or the 1940s gangsters. He should be made pay. That man was caught on camera stealing documents he was going to shred. Yeah. What did he get? 4 years learning to play the guitar and talking about Roosevelt to inmates. Whereas,
by the way, Michael Shields and your family have listened. Great news this week. Michael will be out in a few weeks. No doubt about that. Straw is just trying to cover his backside yet again. But, classic comparison of like how people are treated. No man known to be innocent. Working class football fan from Liverpool. I think he can just stay there in prison. You know?
Yeah. Right. There's no political capital to be made from it, is there?
Made off. Anyway, Elton John, Paddy Hoey on the Brian Reid Show on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. Elton John. I can't really abuse Elton. I've been banned from abusing Elton John in the Mirror.
I like Elton John because he's the only man who can make sacrifice a four-syllable word. Sacrifice.
Well, apparently...
He comes from Watford and he sounds like he's from Detroit. What's going on there?
He's called Reg.
And he's called Reg,
But I can't abuse him. I've been banned from abusing him. He gets his lawyers on to me all the time, but I don't know if he listens to the show. But anyway...
He gets a podcast?
He just gets a podcast. He's listening for you. Paddy had a brilliant show this week at the Echo Arena.
He is brilliant, though, isn't he?
No.
He is brilliant.
No, he's not. But anyway, he had a brilliant show at the Echo Arena, apparently. And I was thinking, if that had been 5 years ago, that would have been one of those concerts where the Echo says the eyes of the world are upon us because Elton John's playing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But because of Capital Culture, it barely gets a mention, which is a good sign at times. But anyway, I think he's a bit of a hypocrite, Sir Elton John.
If you're in the arena, probably it's that you've got the eyes of Birkenhead on you, haven't you? The eyes of Prenton.
Yeah. Anyway, Elton John, he's playing at the... This is a piece in The Guardian which made me laugh. Okay, he plays at the O2 Arena last Saturday night. This was Sir Elton John to the audience during his performance at the O2 venue this weekend. So it's last Saturday night he's playing. Trying to be man of the people, rock and roll, hip. This is Elton John. I understand the finals of X Factor and Strictly Come Dancing on tonight. Thanks for coming out, everyone. Of course, I'd rather have an Alsatian bite my... off.
Yeah.
Than watch either show... And my genital and my balls as well. Okay, so this is what you said about, you know. And they were, Elton, whoa, man of the people. Yeah, anyway, and this was the announcer on the O2 public address system talking to the crowd after the show. Alexandra Burke has won this year's X Factor final tonight. That means you can see her and Elton John perform on stage right here at the O2 on New Year's Eve.
Elton's got a social Tourette's, hasn't he? Elton just can't, he's just... He's just a really bitter old queen, isn't he?
He's got a libel Tourette's. There'll be one landing here somewhere tonight. No, oh yeah.
That's like maybe said that.
But my biggest claim to fame of the last few years, he put down in writing that I ruined his 60th birthday celebrations. I was so chuffed with that. That's what I was to sue.
That's brilliant.
I know. Yeah, he wrote it. He said he had all of his. He said everything went well right across the world. Remember, he had about five different parties, and I did this piece saying that he looked like an old scouser going on the pull of a Sunday afternoon down in the blob shop. And I described how he looked and went through his, and he wants to sue me on about three different grounds for it. Anyway.
That's scousist.
But he put down that man, Brian Reid, ruined my 60th birthday celebrations. There you go.
That's brilliant. That's a man who spends £3 million a year on flowers alone.
Me?
No, yeah, of course you do. Yeah. Why do you think a florist and garden's still open?
Names.
Oh, will you hear this here? I was, you know, because I still read a lot of Irish media as well and listen to a lot of Irish media. But
do you do
this
podcasts?
Week,
no, podcasts.
Apparently, Elton thinks I'm about 7.5 so far. Jack and Katie are still the most popular baby names among parents in Northern Ireland, the statistics and research agency has revealed. Well, that's fair enough. Jack and Katie. I helped run a girls' football team. We've got knows Katie's and
Katie,
but. We've got a KD, who's one of our best players.
KD Lang.
KD, yeah. KD, she's great. But, really hear this here. These are some of the names, Chris and Paul and everybody out in listener land. Really hear this here. These are some of the names that people have been christened in Northern Ireland. This is Northern Ireland. You've got Kivas and Ashlings and Owens. And really hear this here. So you've got Bobby Joe, Bobby D, Brooklyn Lee, Michael Ryan, Jack D. Somebody's called their child Jack D. Apparently somebody in America has called their child Chlamydia. But anyway, here's some of the names in Northern Ireland. Rocklin, Heaven, Maximus. Could you imagine going to like a Catholic grammar school in Dungiven with Owen Quigley? What are you? Maximus, get on the ball. Phoenix, spelt with two X's. AJ and Diesel. But these are the best.
Diesel.
Diesel, yeah. Diesel. Diesel. I'm going down south for my diesel.
His brother's called Unleaded.
Yeah. But these are some of the girls' names in Northern Ireland this year. Like, Northern Ireland's a fairly conservative place. I've always thought with the naming of people. But Indigo Rose, Olympia, Trinity, spelt with I's, Honey, Vanilla, Tea, Serenity, Autumn Lynn, and my favourite, Yo-Yo Gypsy. How can you possibly name someone Yo-Yo Gypsy?
Has Bob Geldof moved to Northern Ireland?
And got really furtive. Yo-Yo Gypsy.
Yo-Yo Gypsy.
Yo-Yo. Yo-Yo Gypsy. Come here. Yo-Yo.
Yeah, but you sure that's not? I mean, there's been a lot of Eastern European immigration to Northern Ireland. How do we know that they are the natives? Yo-Yo Gypsy might be really big in Bulgaria.
Lithuanian. And the best thing about going back
home... It's when you get the tattoos, that's when it's going to look good.
The best thing about going back to Northern Ireland is if you see Northern Ireland people complaining about immigration, they're going, oh, these Lithuanians are moving on. Going, what part of Irish people and immigration don't you understand? What is going on? All those Lithuanians...
I can't leave Northern Ireland, Paddy, without... I held over a story from 2 weeks ago, which, again, must be up for story of the year. Kind of been looked over. Loyalist killer Michael Stone.
It's the feel-good story of the summer.
He got jailed. Now, if you remember, Michael Stone was the one who, at the IRA funeral many years ago, killed three people. He turned up, like, went on the rampage, killed
87,
people.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, a couple of years ago, in 2006, he stormed Stormonts, didn't he? Tried to kill Gerry Adams and McGuinness, stormed in.
In fairness, he didn't do very well, did he? Because the woman security guard and our fat mate, who'd obviously just had a massive fry-up, held him at the door.
Just knocked off from Primark, on the door of Primark. But anyway, so he gets taken to court. What's his defence? It was performance art. Which would have been okay. The problem was when they frisked him, they found he had nail bombs, three knives and a garrote on him. But is that the new excuse? Every time you get done for anything, as well as Bumgarden, if you get done for downloading porn, it's Bumgardener research. Yeah. Okay, you get done for like trying to kill someone, it's performance art.
Yeah. Or if you're going to stab someone, go over and stab them, and then go kick, kick, turn jazz hands, make a performance art. I'm going to kill Gerry Adams and Bob Fosse.
And enter it into the Terror Prize.
Yeah. But the best thing about Michael Stone is, like, I don't know if you saw him.
He's in jail.
But that's one thing. But then Michael Stone's also started off this ridiculous vendetta with Johnny Mad Dog Adair, where he alleged that Johnny Mad Dog Adair may have, shall we say, had a close friendship with a colleague from the LVF whilst in jail, he alleged. And but think, can you think of any more scary vendetta to get involved in? Michael Stone versus Johnny Mad Dog Adair?
Yeah. I call Michael Stone hasn't got a name in the middle, because they're all like Mad Dog.
Yeah.
Maybe his performance art, Michael Performance Artist. Performance artist formerly known as Mad Dog.
His art is appalling. His paintings are awful. Thus proving that you shouldn't do an open university degree whenever you're inside.
We've got to get a capital culture story because we have to get it every week. Phil Redmond in the Daily Post this week.
Shouldn't we have Ian McNabb's impression of Phil Redmond on every time you mention it? That's brilliant.
Yeah, it was good actually.
It was.
Yeah.
Man of 9 million voices.
Yeah. Phil Redmond is talking about the awareness, the success of capital culture. And it has been a success.
It has.
And he's talked about the kind of percentage, you know, the percentages which prove it was a success. Anyway. Research indicated that 70% of people across the UK knew that Liverpool is capital culture, 30% recognised the waterfront, and 99% of the Liverpool population also knew that 2008 was capital culture. That means 1% didn't. Now, if the population of Liverpool is 500,000, that means there's 500 people out there in Liverpool who didn't know that this year was the capital of culture. Has Joseph Fritzl been out here just putting people in a cellar? Because how would you not know that this has been the capital culture?
It's probably everybody who's ever drank in the penny farthing this year.
It kind of got mentioned in it this year, do you reckon?
Do you think so?
500 people were capital culture. What's that?
Sorry, that statistic is that 30% of people recognise the skyline. Thus, putting to an end the lie that was perpetrated by every single senior sub-editor on The Echo when I worked on it, where you had to have Liverpool's world-famous skyline. And I said to people, that's complete nonsense. World-famous skyline, Sydney, Manhattan. And they're going, no, you ask anybody in the world, they'll know exactly what Liverpool's skyline looks like. They know the Radio City logo. Nonsense.
I agree. I think that the other 70%, they were like in Burkina Faso. And they hadn't had access to a telly.
They'd never seen the start at Brookside.
Okay, what's more recognisable?
Westminster.
That's not really
Eiffel
Tower.
That's
on the side of a river. No, you're talking about buildings now. Waterfronts.
Yeah. Sydney Opera House.
Manhattan. Sydney is because of one building. Okay.
I can't believe you're getting all scousist on me now.
I just decided to.
You spend your entire life exploding myths. Now you're just gonna.
This isn't a myth.
It is a myth. Liverpool's world-famous waterfront was world-famous in 1902 because people left it to get to New York. And the last thing they saw was that church is now disused in Waterloo. Nobody knows what outside of Liverpool or outside of Britain knows what the City Tower or the Labour buildings look like.
They listen to the podcast and they know where it's coming from.
Yes.
You don't believe that. Name me five more recognisable waterfronts in the world. I've fallen into that one now.
You really have.
I'll give you
level.
New York.
Give me.
Give you Sydney.
The river Thames in London.
That's not a waterfront. That's just about Big Ben.
Oh, don't give me that, will you? What about the Parisian waterfront then, going cruising up towards Montmartre?
That's the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, Eiffel Tower.
What about the Belfast waterfront?
Belfast waterfront is completely unmemorable. I'll give you that. That's because we were exporting our bodies to you because you were stealing off us.
What about the red car waterfront? Chris, you've got to come and defend that.
No. Can I say headlines of the week?
Yeah.
And best headlines of the week are made up because I found something called the Random Daily Mail Headline Generator, which is you just hit a button and it comes up with random headlines. But I'll get to that. But my two favourites are Turkish transsexual star acquitted of insulting army. Surely that's just a series of random words that have been thrown together. Or, doctor removes perfectly formed foot growing inside baby's brain. Isn't that brilliant? Wouldn't you have killed
what
Brian? You were the stones. I was done by the Daily Mail's foreign service. Like they've got their own like foreign diplomatic service. It's the Mail's foreign service. You were Stone's sub on The Echo, weren't you, for years on the Daily Post? Would you not have killed to write the headline, doctor removes, in inverted commas, perfectly formed foot growing inside baby's brain?
If you could add, in the shadow of the most famous waterfront on earth.
just off the M58. But Chris Applegate...
That's all headlines are, random words thrown together. We know that.
Yeah, I know, but this is brilliant. Chris Applegate, who's a 20-something geek and wannabe polymath, has programmed something on the internet called the Random Daily Mail Headline Generator. And so I've got five Random Daily Mail headlines, which are brilliant. Do single mothers defraud the elderly?
Are these real headlines?
This is, will the unions kill the Queen? Will Chris Morris rob the countryside blind? My two favourites. I'm sorry. I shouldn't really be laughing at it, man. It's not really.
But these sound like real headlines. And that's the whole point, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks for letting light in on the magic there. That's the man who explains jokes. A horse walks into a bar. Why would a horse walk into a bar? Thanks, Brian. Could paedophiles hurt the countryside? And my favourite, could Brian Paddock rip off the memory of Diana? That's just the greatest headline in the world.
There was actually, I'm going to go straight to a Daily Mail headline this week and explain a great story. This was the headline, Paddy. What the sacking of posh Ed tells us about the BBC's hang-ups over class. Okay? Ed Stoughton has been sacked. He hasn't even been sacked from the Today programme. He's a freelance journalist.
He's a freelancer, and secondly, he's got until October to make £100,000.
His contract's up, and they've said, okay, what we want to do is we want to have a bit of a shake-up. Okay, yeah. So, cheers, Ed. You've been great. Now go. The Daily Mail have decided to take, and the Chattering Classes have said this is an attack, another attack on Middle England, another regionalist attack on what's great about this country. So they got Sir Max Hastings.
Yes, yeah.
Charterhouse, Oxford Daily Telegraph. Yeah. So explain this to us, okay.
Irish Rifles.
Okay. In the case of Stoughton, the BBC gossip suggests that he has been dismissed from his role as presenter of the Today programme because he sounds too toffish, okay? I have no idea whether this is true, but it's very believable. He then goes on to have a rant about...
So is that a journalist writing the words, I have no idea that this is true, but it's believable? Surely that's the definition of what journalism shouldn't be about.
So he says, almost every day we see on our screens or hear on the radio reports of presenters whose only obvious credentials are that they are young or female or black or possibly gay or boast a Celtic or regional accent. Okay, that's their only credentials. He knows this, okay. It must be right to promote diversity on air. The BBC's mistake, however, is to elevate popular culture and those who peddle it to represent the highest good. Elitism, the pursuit of excellence, must continue to command respect in any properly directed national broadcasting organisation. So what he's saying is, this is an attack on toffs. They want to throw someone in there who's got like a Celtic accent, or he's gay, yeah, or he's black, or he's female. Who's replacing him?
It's Justin Webb.
Justin Webb. Who went to Sidcot School, £6,600 per term,
yeah.
Okay, and the LSE, and has got a mouth full of plums and cutlery.
He's a man also who came out in favour of the neocons, didn't he? He famously pushed the McCain agenda during the American election. That's the only reason they've got him in.
Well, an attack on toffs.
That's complete, complete nonsense.
There's none of that at City Talk. If you listen, we'll have toffs, we'll have any toffs here, won't we? Eh?
If you listen really closely to Max Hastings, you lift the Daily Mail up and hold it to your ear, all you can hear is because he's mental.
The best of Brian Reid on City Talk 105.9.
In this show, what would it be in the season to get sozzled? I thought we'd have a good half an hour talking about boozing and boozers. And I've got a couple of writers who've brought out books about ale. About ale, that's right. First up is Chris Routledge. Routledge, of course, yeah. He was author of Keynes, The Story of Liverpool in a Pint, which is a really fascinating book. And we've just been talking fascinatingly off-air about the history of it, because it is. The whole history of drinking in this city and drink itself is really fascinating.
This was one of the most debauched and drunken cities in Victorian England. In Victorian England. Yeah. It probably is now as well, but it was one of the most drunken places in the country, in the Victorian period.
So we're talking about the mid 19th century.
Was this when
Keynes started?
Well, Robert Keynes started. He started his brewing operation in about 1850. So he was right in the. He was really taking advantage of that. It was a huge. There was a huge boom. I mean, absolutely enormous. I mean, it just went wild from about 1830 onwards, right up into the 1870s. It was just an incredible explosion
of alcohol consumption
in beer production, beer drinking, pubs, beer houses, everything really.
What was that down to?
A lot of people moved into the cities for work. I mean, huge numbers. It was, the conditions were pretty horrible. The living conditions were horrible. So going to the pub and getting drunk was a way of avoiding lying down next to rats and in your own sewage, basically.
But that's what they did then in the pub.
Well, yeah, I mean, the housing was just atrocious. I mean, really, I mean, if you were, you know, it was so unhealthy. I mean, really, really horrible. And a lot of the drinking was just to escape from that, really.
So, yeah.
Pretty grim, really.
So there's this explosion of pubs. All of a sudden there's a pub. There is a pub on every corner, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we talk about Scotland Road where there's been like 8 pubs in a street. And at the time, that was the biggest concentration of housing in the world.
Well, that's pretty close to where Robert Keynes started brewing. He was on Limekiln Lane, which is just...
He didn't start in the Dingle?
No. He started... It was just off Limekiln Lane, down from Scotland Road. Yeah. So that's where he started. So he's right there where all the Irish immigrants were.
And he was Irish himself.
Yeah, he came over as a little kid. With his parents, and and grew up in those slums, actually.
So tell us about the man and his story. He became incredibly wealthy, didn't he, on the back of it?
He did. He did. He became incredibly wealthy. Yeah. The funny thing about Robert Caine is there's so many myths about him that have grown up. You know, there's lots of stories, a lot of them contradictory, and we seem to have kind of got this vision of Robert Caine that's not quite as it was. He came over here a lot earlier than seems to be thought, as a toddler rather than as an 18-year-old, and grew up in Liverpool. He was pretty much of Liverpool rather than of Ireland, although he was born in Ireland. And he was sent to sea by his father, I think, indentured to a cooper on a ship going to West Africa to collect palm oil. And when he came back, being a cooper in a city where there were thousands
of
pubs,
put something in it.
Was a really great idea. Yeah. Yeah, don't put oil in it, put beer in it. Yeah. So he started making barrels down off Scotty Road, and that was it. And started brewing as well at the same time.
And again, something I learned from the book is that it was his design for the pubs like the Philharmonic and the Grapes.
On
Lime Street, the Big House.
Yeah,
yeah, which are fabulous buildings. If you look inside, I mean. Yeah. And that kind of, you kind of think, you've explained this to me, but I just thought it was kind of one-upmanship. Oh, come and have a look around my pub. It's got marble toilets. It's got red, beautiful tiling. But what you explained to me, which is interesting, is that actually they tried to make drinking look respectable.
Yeah, it was partly one-upmanship, but also they wanted to make sure that they weren't shut down, basically. They wanted to make sure that the middle classes started drinking, because the middle classes were voting for the temperance campaigners. So they wanted the middle classes to see that you could actually go to the pub and have a nice conversation and a pleasant...
So that's why they got marble toilets?
Absolutely.
That's why it's called the Philharmonic Dining Room?
Absolutely.
Yeah, this isn't just a pub, this is...
Yeah, I mean, what have the pubs done in the last 20 years to get people in? They've started serving food.
Unfortunately.
Well, exactly the same thing happened in the late 19th century. It's exactly
because
the same idea.
You were telling me, too. So you got this explosion. Everyone's drinking. All of a sudden, there's horrific scenes. There's debauchery. There's drunkenness.
Yeah.
We're running the world, but our workforce are permanently drunk.
Yeah.
So they start to think they nearly banned it, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, it came pretty close, yeah. In the 1890s, especially, it was pretty close to prohibition. I mean, it happened in America
in the 20s,
and it could have happened here too in the late 19th century. Yeah, it was pretty close. It was the Liberal Party were the ones who were supported by the temperance campaign. They weren't all temperance campaigners, but they were the ones who were supported by it. And as the Liberal Party grew in Liverpool. And started to push out the Tories. It was pretty close to being banned in Liverpool. It was certainly under a huge amount of pressure, and to clean up.
And that's why we got a Liberal government during the First World War that introduces licensing hours.
Yeah,
The first time, and that was due to the munitions workers in Carlisle. Yeah. They were so drunk they couldn't go back to work.
Yeah, that's right.
So they said, you can't drink, you know, you can only drink from 12 till 3. And
that's right, yeah. They stopped them drinking all day.
And they stayed in place till Thatcher, till the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. The really weird thing, I think this is one thing that we don't get about the Victorians, is that they used to drink an awful lot of very weak beer because the water was so awful that you couldn't drink it. You would die if you drank the water. So people would drink weak beer.
What percentage about?
2-3%. But that would be what they drank. That was, you know, I've got a bottle of water here. It would be a bottle of beer in 1850.
If what were the working class people?
Everybody.
Really?
Yeah. If you could, what you couldn't drink the water, neat. If you had to drink the water, you were going to get sick.
Yeah.
And it tasted bad as well, as far as I can figure out. It tasted salty.
So tell us, you mentioned to me that in the Victorian times, Liverpool had a terrible drinking problem.
Yeah.
We think today we've got one, don't we, with underage drinkers. People point to scenes of a Saturday night at 2 in the morning. Presumably this was commonplace everywhere and happening during the day.
Yeah.
Really?
It was bad. I mean, there's no point in putting a good spin on it. It was a horrible thing. I mean, it was people didn't live long in 19th century Liverpool. So, you know, you weren't going to make it past 50, so
that's what
exactly. I mean, it was one of the contributing things to that, I'm sure. Yeah. It must have been. It was very severe. I mean, it's...
But it didn't bother old Mr. Kane, did it? Because I'll make a few bob out of this.
Well, he was doing fine. Yeah, absolutely. And he was quite. You know, he was a big politician around Liverpool as well.
Big Tory, wasn't he?
Yeah, behind the scenes, he never stood for office, but he was behind the scenes in the Tory party and quite important.
Was one of the things that endeared him to the Tory party the fact that the Liberals wanted to ban drinking?
I think probably in the long run that's what it was. Yeah. But the Tory party in Liverpool was basically run by the big merchants, and so it was the party of the merchants and the kind of small business owners, and so they ran the city to their benefit, basically, as you would, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
But Keynes is seen as the Liverpool brewery.
Yeah.
Why was there only one big brewery in Liverpool? For such a, I mean, Greenalds came from Warrington, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Tetley's
is Leeds, and there was Walkers of Warrington as
Walkers of Warrington, yeah.
Yeah.
But you would have thought that Liverpool would have had more than one brewery.
Liverpool had a lot of breweries. But in the 19th century, there was Joplin's, Higson's.
There's Bent's.
Bent's.
Yeah, of course. There was a whole, Higson's from
Moscow. The Windsor Brewery. Yeah. There were a whole bunch of them. I mean, really lots of them. Yeah. Loads of them. But of course, it's real estate, and it gets, when the breweries merge, they only need really one brewery.
Yeah.
So in 1920s, when Keynes, the company Keynes, merged with Walker's, the brewery itself, the brewery we see now, was sold off and became Higson's. And the Higson's brewery, which had Higson's had taken over the Windsor Brewery on Parliament Street, and they ditched that and moved to the current Keynes brewery. Yeah. So as they merged, they only needed one.
Yeah. And of course, we have this great, you know, rising from the ashes, don't we? Yeah. When the brothers, the Dussange brothers, make it this fantastic brand again.
Yeah,
and then they get into trouble.
Yeah, yeah. It's just I was talking to them the other day. They've been good enough to show up for our press call on Monday, and I was talking to them the other day, and I think they've kind of realised that actually they used to talk to me about how they were part of a Liverpool tradition and all the rest of it, and I think they've realised that they actually are still part of a Liverpool tradition of this up and down kind of,
yes,
you know, and I think they've been lucky to get away with it, but
they basically overstretched themselves, didn't they?
They overdid it.
They bought about 100.
Well, yeah, they merged with a company that was a pubco, and it brought 100 pubs with it. And the pub company was in trouble, and they were trying to turn it around. And then the bank withdrew funding, so as banks were doing at the time. So I think they did what a lot of people have done. You know, they bought houses and companies and what have you on the top of a what they thought was going to be a never-ending boom, and it hasn't been.
Yeah. So. But you think they're going to survive? They're going to be okay? I mean, so it's going now. It's a running concern.
Yeah, it's a running concern, and they seem to have held on to, according to them, they've held on to most of their customers. So I think they're in a pretty good position. It's difficult to say.
Yeah, of course.
I think they've held on to a pretty good position. They've got a fallback. They've reached a fallback position, and I think they're in position. They've got the advantage they've got, apart from the brewing. Real Ale is doing okay against all the odds. It seems to be. And local Real Ale seems to be doing all right in hard times. But they've also got a big, important canning line, which does canning and bottling for all kinds of other breweries. So they've got this kind of double business going, which I think is probably pretty secure, I would think.
And how well respected is Keynes beer around Britain and around the world?
Well, Camra are big supporters of the beer. I mean, it's one of the things that they've done is they've gone for volume, of course, but they've also gone for quality, and I think that was a really good idea.
Yeah.
Because the quality beer is the one that seems to be now surviving in the recession. So, I think that was a good plan, and it does seem to be pretty well respected by the real aficionados of beer. So,
and how many people are employed in Keynes Brewery in Liverpool?
90, I think. 90-ish.
It's important that we.
It's very
keep
important.
That going.
Oh, it's a big employer. Yeah, it's a big employer. Yeah.
Okay, that's Chris Routledge. He's got a book out called Keynes: The Story of Liverpool and a Pint. I'm joined by another author now, Paul Moody, who's got a book out called The Rough Pub Guide: A Celebration of the Great British Boozer. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Are you okay?
Yeah, not bad.
Got a hangover?
Yeah, quite a big one.
You've got to. You might have an ale on, you know, it's Christmas. Sorry, I forgot to ask you, Chris, you haven't got a hangover, have you?
I haven't. I've been sick, so I've not been able to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's why you're sitting with a bottle of water.
Yeah, that's right.
Paul, we've just been talking about Keynes Brewing. In fact, how debauched this country was in the middle of the last century, well, the middle of the 19th century, you know. Are we still a very boozy nation, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's the irony is we've got these sort of two messages going on, you know, that constantly this thing about binge Britain, the fact that everyone's out, you know, getting drunk all the time. But in actual fact, I think we're doing it in a different way, and that's the problem. I think the pub is losing its position in the middle of things, and people are drinking at home, and so people are drinking probably more than they ever were, but we're losing the tradition of the pub as this thing which was at the centre of it, and I think that's the real worry, I think.
Yeah. Chris mentioned the fact that, and I didn't know this, but kind of around in the 1800s, when these grand pubs were being built in Liverpool, like the Philharmonic and the Grapes, the reasons they did it was to try and make drinking acceptable, because it was on the verge of being closed down, the pubs, and they did that by putting food in. Now, that's what's happened over the last 20 years, and I know you hate, like me, the gastropub.
Well, you know, General Gastro himself, Ramsay's got a lot to answer
Gastro,
for. I mean, basically, you know, the problem is people used to go to the pub and it's a, you know, a classless situation. You can all go in there and it's a, you know, you buy a drink. Suddenly, all these pubs have turned into these weird sort of quasi-restaurants. Mm. In actual fact, you go to those places and you don't get out of there without spending £50 or something.
And you feel uncomfortable sometimes, don't you? Oh, sorry, I've only come in here for a pint. Have I got to order something off the starter list?
It's totally that, and it's like, you know, who wants to eat an aardvark's egg?
Mm. Oh, me, please. I'd like to see what one of them looks like.
But I just think sometimes go to a restaurant, you know, to a restaurant, and you know the pub as we know it does need to survive, doesn't it? It's an iconic institution in this country, isn't it?
Well, it's really weird. I mean, is it true about the Philharmonic? They said that the only reason for the City of Culture thing was because the committee went to the Philharmonic at the end of the evening. is that an urban myth? But
if it's an urban myth, it's a good one, isn't it?
but that says it all, doesn't
yeah,
it? It's like
it does.
The pub is the place where you can all... I don't know, you know, it's can't even put it into words, can you? It's like this amazing thing. It really is under threat, which is so scary at the moment. And they're turning the ones that are surviving are the genuine article. But most of the time you go into these refurbs and it's not a pub, is it? There's no actual word for what it is, but it isn't a pub.
One of the things about the food in the Philharmonic in the 19th century was that it wasn't a kind of gastro food at all. It was people who were coming out of work and going to get a pie. Mm. You know, it was their meal.
Yeah.
So, which is an entirely different thing. It's like a kind of, you know, it's where you go because you don't have a kitchen.
Oh, it was okay when you used to that little thing in the corner with a few pies in. I didn't mind that. You know, had some pickled eggs.
Yeah, I'm talking about 1890.
Well, Paul, this book is basically you've looked at what you think of the 50 of the best pubs in the country. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean,
any Liverpool pubs? You've got to ask because that's all we're obsessed about up here. Any Liverpool pubs?
Well, only the Swan, I'm afraid.
Oh, the Swan! Now there is a legendary pub, isn't it? You're not a greasy biker by any chance, are you?
Well, I used to live up there in 84, 85, and when we went back, I mean, it's still exactly the same.
Oh.
I've always coming up there quite a lot, but
it's the same people that were there that night. They haven't gone home. They're hugging the same pint of cider, mate, and listening to that Led Zeppelin song.
Well, I think that there was a review in the Echo, and it sort of said, you know, no one dares for you to go into the cubicle of the men's loo because tentacles might come up and drag you down into the abyss. And you know, that's a recommendation in my book.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
what made you pick the Swan in Wood Street? Just is it kind of you're looking at weird and wacky pubs, or pubs with a bit of character?
Character, yeah. I think, that, you know, the frustrating thing was, I think we all feel the same way, you know, obviously we like going to the pub, and yet most of those pub guides are, like, about as interesting as the telephone directory.
Yeah.
And you know, camera do a good job and everything, but we just wanted to concentrate on the atmosphere of places.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't really matter about the quality of the beer, does it?
No.
And the Swan was just, I mean, Peter Cavanagh's, I mean, there's, you know, the White Star, there's loads, aren't there, obviously, all the obvious Liverpool ones. Yeah, crack and stuff. It just felt like the Swan is a place where there's a pretty much, you know, you kind of know what you're going to get in there, and it's rock.
Well, I went in Caverners last night, and I hadn't been there for ages, and I was just saying, because of this time of year, it's full of once-a-year boozers, isn't it? And every pub in Liverpool was jammed to the, even the crack. I couldn't get in the crack last night. So we went to Peter Caverners, which I haven't been to for ages, and again, you're hit by the characters you walk in. And the manager pulled a pint of Guinness, going, best pint of Guinness in Liverpool, that lad, ban on. So he said to him, okay, what's the second best pint? He went, Pug Bones, but I don't want to talk about it.
Well, the thing about Cavanagh's is like, I was in there, you know, going there, and like the guy comes around trying to sell you books at 11 o'clock. I mean, it makes a change from a DVD of, you know, Batman.
Well, you know, in the 80s, I mean, that was where Liverpool did all his trade in the pubs, basically. You know, fish fingers, yeah. Shoes, jewellery, yeah, cigarettes. Yeah. You know, you didn't go shopping. It's before the internet. Yeah. You just sat there.
Yeah, and Liverpool's got such a great pub tradition, hasn't it? And obviously, it's like, you just think, these places are just, you know, they are under threat, and it's like, where did the bands form? You know, the Mersey Poets, the whole bit, you know.
That's right, yeah.
We lose so much stuff if we just sort of sit at home drinking, and that's kind of the way it's been, almost like people being pushed towards doing that, because it's just so much cheaper, and it's just, you know, it's quite worrying, really.
Well, the clothes are the rate of four a week now, aren't they?
Yeah.
And as you've called it, Paul, it's an endangered species, the pub.
And the thing is, when we were driving around, you know, you go into Nottingham and places like that, you know, it's literally like a pub graveyard. It's so depressing, you know. You think all these places, you know, really amazing looking buildings and so much history in them, and, you know, without any preservation orders on any of them, they're just going to be knocked down, and no one would even know they were there.
Well, Nottingham's got some spectacular... I used to live in Nottingham for a while, and did you go to the trip to Jerusalem?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what an amazing place that is. It's a
great name.
It's a cave.
Yeah.
But I must say, we turned up there, and there was, like, an American tourist outside, you know, like about 30 of them. It almost felt like it had turned into this kind of...
Right.
You know, like a historical interest place rather than what it should be, great old pub.
What a shame.
But what you say, what we both say is true, because if anybody said to me, Liverpool is the capital of culture this year, as you probably know, European capital of culture, but if anybody said to me, you know, I've just landed in Liverpool, I've never been here before, tell me where's the best place to go where I'll find out about the city, I would direct them to pubs. Definitely. I would say, go to the Jacaranda, go to the Grapes in Matthew Street, go to the Casa, go to the Big House, and that's where you discover the nature of the people and the city, and have a good time. And that's what pubs are about, aren't they, Bo?
Well, the frustrating thing is it's almost like they want to, they want to sort of change the character of the town without acknowledging the actual facts of them, what the actual town is like.
That's a really good point, actually.
It's like King's Cross, you know, not to drone on about London things, but it's like, you know, that's an absolute fallacy that the King's Cross is this kind of gleaming... You know, it's a nightmare. Yeah. And you need, like, a proper local pub to at least, you know, okay, that's where I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, same with anywhere, isn't it? I mean, you only understand what the place is like when you see what the pubs are like.
Yeah. But are we talking about evolution here, Chris? I mean, you mentioned that when Keynes built their pubs, you know, and there was eight, in some streets, there was three or four pubs, wasn't there? Because there was this massive demand. There was nothing else to do but go and get drunk, basically.
Well, a lot of the places, it's really, Liverpool was a funny place in the 19th century, but a lot of these pubs were actually behind shops. So you'd go through a shop, into the pub, and then behind the pub would be like a court where people lived. So you'd have to go through a shop and a pub to get to where you lived.
So you have to stop off. Yeah,
exactly. There was probably a queue to get out the back anyway. But yeah, I mean, there is an element of evolution, but I think it's a real mistake to allow evolution just to go mad, because it ends up killing off stuff that you want later. And I think pubs are one of those things. If we lose this now, we won't get it back again. It can't come back.
I know, exactly. Yeah. It's a craze, isn't it? It's been going on for 10 years, and people have suddenly realised that perhaps they want what the traditional pub was back.
Yeah.
And before we know it, we'll have, you know, lost this thing.
Yeah, and it's not the same as when the kind of refurbs are turned into a traditional pub, because they, you know, they look like them, and they kind of have hops hanging from the ceiling, but they're just not the same thing as something that's been there for 700 years and has been falling down that long as well. It's kind of that plastic.
But if you look at something like Liverpool, that went through a phase, not as much now, but where there's a new pub opening in town every week in the city centre, and you kind of pub. But when I was outside of town, and I'm from Wavertree, and there used to be a famous pub called Wavertree. Yeah. From the coffee machine to the coffee machine. Now I would say two-thirds of those pubs have gone. Yeah. You know, it's so outside where people live, we can blame, you know, you can get cans of lager for 50 pence in the supermarkets you can stay in. Wasn't what I would call the old man's boozer of the old days, which were in working class areas, wasn't it inevitable they would go? Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it is that some of these pubs, that there were, you know, crazy amount of pubs, and when you look back on it now, perhaps some of them did have to go. There is a natural element to it, but the weirdest thing is that, you know, when we went across the whole country, Liverpool, so obviously the civic spirit resonates through the pubs more than anywhere else, and in Liverpool most of all. And you think some of these places, okay, they do have to go, there is a natural element of that, but there are local pubs which are probably people have gone to for years, and there's a, you know, sing song there, the real genuine article, yeah. and they are going purely because the smoking ban is idiotic laws that have come in, and the pub companies are basically, we are losing some great places as well. That's the worst of it.
So tell us about your book, Paul. It's called a celebration of the great British booze. Is it kind of a, you know, an alternative guide to the best boozers in the country?
Pretty much. I mean, I think we're trying to say that sometimes a great pub is just one that's open.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, yeah. in the end, we've got to, even the slightly knockabout pubs, you know, some of the ones in there, you might not go in there. They don't look, you think, oh, this is not very prepossessing. But when you actually go in there, they turn out to be the best ones.
Yeah.
And all this sort of hype, you know, constantly going on about the new places or something that you should be going to. In actual fact, traditional pubs, even if it's just got a jukebox in the corner, you know, the guy behind the bar's been there for 30 or 40 years, which quite a lot of the pubs in the book have been, you know, they've had like two landlords since the war. These are the places we should be cherishing.
I'm glad you mentioned jukeboxes, because that's the one thing I missed. That's the one thing that's getting phased out of pubs, you know, which I love a good jukebox. Yeah. Like the Jacaranda has got a fabulous jukebox. If a pub's got a great jukebox, you'll go there because you may want to listen to a few old songs or, you know, and they're getting phased out. And the reason is the cost again, because it costs a hell of a lot to put a jukebox in.
And sympathies are with the people running the pubs. It's like, you know, the landlords at time forgot, we call them in the book, but really these people are like public servants. They're doing as good a job as anybody else, you know, who gets some sort of a claim, and yet they get... Do you know what I mean? It's so frustrating that you think these pubs are fantastic places, and we've grown up going to them and pretty much, you know, meet your girlfriend and, you know, you change your life, these places, and they don't get any real acknowledgement. And now they're under threat, and you think, well, you know, there's 55,000 pubs left, but, you know, there's not like any sort of acknowledgement of it. That's what gets me.
What's the weirdest pub in the country?
Well, I must say the obvious one for me is the Yew Tree it's outside Stoke, Calden Waterhouses. Absolutely incredible pub. I mean, the guy, Alan Yates, the landlord's been there for 46 years. It's an absolutely crazy pub.
Why is it going? What's crazy about it?
Well, the guy's, it's pre-decimal till. He's got all the pumps are like, you know, double diamond. I mean, things it's like an episode of Life on Mars, basically.
And it's fabulous.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, as soon as you walk in there, it's like some pubs, you know, you walk in there, you never want to leave. And that's, you know, how often do you find that when you go to some sort of homogenised, you know, Frog and Firkin?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I mean, obviously, Liverpool's got some incredible places, hasn't it? I mean, Chris must know a lot of them, but you think, well, you know, in 50 years' time, will they still be there?
Chris?
I think city centres are a different thing. There's going to be, I mean, there are just gems in Liverpool, as there are in all cities. I wonder, Liverpool's had a funny history, because there was all that in the 60s when people moved out to the new suburbs. I think that's got a lot to do with the decline of the pub as well, actually, because if you have to drive into work and then drive home again, you're too knackered to go out at the end of the day after that. You know, it adds that extra time in your day, and whereas people used to work near to where they, you know, lived near to where they worked, and it meant that the pub was near to where you lived and where you worked, and it was a lot more convenient. It was more part of the community. I think it's a serious issue that we have to deal with, because there's lots of things happening all at once to be in the way of the pub. We have to think about it pretty hard, I think.
Well, they're open now, lads. So, so I know you two fine drinkers will want to put a yard of ale down your neck now before lunchtime. And with it being Christmas, there's a good excuse. One thing, though, you don't go to a pub on Christmas night, do you?
No.
Paul? You do. Go on, tell me you
open.
Do. It always used to be tickets only, you know, tickets only to a pub. And
I mean, do you?
No, I used to. I used to be like, find out what pub's open, open. Then you get in, there's like 8 million people at the bar.
Yeah. You know,
tickets only. But it's the one night of the year I stay in.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Paul Moody, author of The Rough Pub Guide to Celebrate the Great British Music. Hope the book goes well. It's available in bookshops, is it, obviously?
Yeah, it's out there, yeah.
Good luck there, Paul.
And Chris, Story of Liverpool and the Pints, Liverpool bookshops will get that?
Yeah, they've got that now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there you go. If you want to sit there over Christmas, reading about ale, drinking ale, stuffing your faces, there's the books. Thanks, lads. You've been listening to the best of Brian Reid. I'll be back next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for Tricia Goddard here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
The best of Brian Reid, City Talk 105.9.